Straight Talk from Israel.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio. You're listening to the Jay Shapiro Show.
Hello again. Thanks for listening. This is Jay Shapiro. This week I will say a few words about a topic that I thought had vanished at the end of the Second World War, when the atrocities against the Jewish people that were done by the Nazis and those who cooperated with them were made known. The topic is, of course, anti-Semitism. There's not enough time in my program to discuss all the new manifestations of this old hate, but it must be mentioned because it's becoming an issue of renewed importance. And this renewal is manifested both in Europe and in the United States. In Europe, particularly in France, anti-Semitism has reared its ugly head in the form of swastikas on gravestones, a Jew shot with an air rifle outside a Paris synagogue, a prominent Jewish intellectual and public figure called a dirty Jew, and other similar incidents. And in particular, the so-called Yellow Vest movement that began as a protest against rising fuel tax prices by the working class and the middle class has taken on a violent anti-Semitic aspect and has very rapidly segued from a social protest to a new form of anti-Semitism, sometimes violent. That's what's happening in the land of liberty, equality, and fraternity. Meanwhile, in the United States, the Democratic Party, to which 70-80% of American Jews give their votes, has turned far to the left, and this radical left includes members of Congress who are outright anti-Semites, who have been given places by the leadership of the party on important congressional committees to deal with foreign relations and foreign aid. This has not bode well for Jews in the United States, nor the relationship between the United States and Israel. Unfortunately, the organized Jewish community is turning a blind eye to this phenomenon, which is still in its infancy, but it's growing rapidly. This permissive attitude to the rapid rise of age-old anti-Semitism not only forms like anti-Israelism, but also in its traditional form of accusations against the Jews for being money lovers and things like that, of that nature. It's got to be nipped in the bud. I'll say a few words about that on the upcoming segments in the program. Again, thanks for listening.
Always challenging the status quo. Hello, I'm Rod Bryant on Beyond the Matrix here at IsraelNewsTalkRadio.com. I want to encourage you to listen each week, every Wednesday at the same time, for an amazing show that will challenge you, inform you, and inspire. News, views, and wisdom for the nations. Here on IsraelNewsTalkRadio.com. Don't forget, Beyond the Matrix every week, Wednesday, here on IsraelNewsTalkRadio.com.
You're listening to The Jay Shapiro Show.
Hello again. You're back with Jay Shapiro. I want to say a few words about anti-Semitism and the developing new face of the Democratic Party in the United States. When I was a kid in the United States, every Jew that I knew voted Democratic. The Republicans were seen as the party of the rich and comfortable, and the Democrats were seen as the party of the poor and the immigrants. This was based to a large extent on the experience of the immigrant society, like my parents and my grandparents. And this was further fostered by the belief that President Roosevelt had saved the world from Nazism. Now, this was true. But there was a dark side of Roosevelt and his attitude toward the Holocaust and the closing of the gates of the United States to Jews trying to escape. Almost all of this was unknown to the average person, and we only became aware of it after the Second World War. and Jews continue to vote Democratic in huge majorities up to today. Sociology studies have shown that as Jews rise in economic position as opposed to other religious and ethnic groups, they continue to vote Democratic. It has humorously been said, but truly said, that the Jews earn like Episcopalians and vote like Puerto Ricans. Now, a new element has appeared on a political scene in the United States. The Democratic Party is trying to increase the diversity within the party and to appeal more widely to various groups, many of which are extreme in their views. This may make sense, but it has blinded the Democratic Party leadership to certain aspects of this new extremism that do not bode well for the future of the Jewish community in the United States or for the United States itself. I don't want to be an alarmist, but certain things are happening in the United States that cannot be ignored. Anti-Semitism is indeed raising its ugly head in the United States, as it is, by the way, elsewhere in the world. The Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organization, Malcolm Honlein, he's the executive chairman, stated that a hotline is being inundated with calls for American students suffering from anti-Semitism on their campuses. In Brooklyn recently, there have been at least 10 unprovoked attacks on Jews within the last several months. And nobody can or should forget the attack on a synagogue in Pittsburgh last year, in which 11 Jews were murdered during Shabbat prayers. The attacks are coming from left and right, but they are not coming in a vacuum. Now, we have a House Representative, Ilhan Omar, who's been in the news quite a bit recently, as she's had to issue not one but two apologies in a short period of 3 weeks for using anti-Semitic remarks. About a month ago, she was asked about a comment she made in 2012 accusing Israel of hypnotizing the world. She insisted she was confused as to why American Jews were offended by this comment, implying that she was unaware that accusing Jews of hypnotizing others to do their dirty work is an anti-Semitic trope. Her comments, she said something called, "It's all about Benjamins, baby." Benjamins meaning the $100 bills, and incorrectly calling AIPAC, a lobbying organization for Israel, she referred to them in a sense that reflects the ancient conspiracy theory that Jews control the world with bottomless pockets. These are deeply and undoubtedly anti-Semitic remarks. Her comments are deeply offensive and unfitting for someone on the Foreign Affairs Committee of the U.S. Congress, and yet the response by non-Jewish or Israeli media have been very pathetic. A number of journalists and pundits accuse the Jews of overreacting. We're not responding to this scandal that has been overwhelmingly focused on Israel. They should really explore the actual anti-Semitism behind the comments. Jews are an ancient people who have survived centuries of persecution. Part of that survival is our ability to notice patterns, and we know that Jew hatred doesn't start as genocide. It starts with anti-Semitic comments and rhetoric that demonize and paint the Jews as the other, so we can more easily be blamed for the world's ills. If you're a media outlet claiming the Jews are overreacting, don't understand why it was a big deal enough that the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, demanded Omar to apologize. These outlets dismiss a minority group's unfounded fears. This is simply not true. If Jews are telling you a comment is anti-Semitic, a non-Jew does not have to tell them that it is not. That's not how it works. When a politician says something anti-black, these same media outlets do not turn around and tell black people they're wrong and exaggerating. That is a double standard. While most minorities are getting more of a voice in the United States, Jewish voices and concerns are being not only dismissed, but outright mocked. The response many journalists have had is outright nonsensical. Their articles focus on Israel, the Netanyahu government policies, and Omar's views on Israel, the war in 2012 when she made the Jews hypnotize the world comment. and applaud her deflecting anti-Semite apologies while outright ignoring that the outcry is not because of her stance on Israel, but that her comments are classic anti-Semitic tropes that have been used for thousands of years. You can disagree with Israel's policies, but we're talking now about anti-Semitism. Certainly she has the right to criticize Israel, and she should be taught what Israel's all about. But her words were said in Israel. However, the blowback is because the words she chose were anti-Semitic, not because they were anti-Israel. Jews constantly find themselves having to explain where the line is, and this is a perfect example. No one in the pro-Israel crowd has been complaining about her misled stance on Israel showcased in these comments. She hates Israel, that's fine. The complaints are because of the Jew hatred laced into her comments, which she has now made repeatedly. By ignoring that reality and refusing to explain to non-Jews who may be confused why such words are so hurtful, these media outlets are implying such rhetoric is acceptable and therefore contributing to the growing levels of outspoken anti-Semitism in the United States. They should be explaining why Jews were so offended by her words and discussing the line, and there is a line, a strong line, between Israel hatred and Jew hatred. Instead, what they've done, they've chosen to dismiss it and mock it and deflect or redirect the conversation in order to bend over backwards to avoid condemning the Jew hate deeply embedded in her words. So she said she wants to learn more about anti-Semitic. That's a laugh. She repeated several times in the anti-Semitic remarks, so to some it is deeply concerning. Not only were her words offensive in the first place, but the fact is how the media has largely chosen to respond not only adds to the offense, but it further raises alarm bells for the many Jews who are concerned with the state of the world and the state of the attitude in the United States toward the Jews. She's not shied away, by the way, from voicing her support for the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, the infamous BDS movement, and she says the things that are anti-Israel, which she's entitled to. Both she and another new Muslim member of Congress, Rashida Tlaib from Michigan, are the first Muslim women elected to Congress. Both seem to use their position to attack Israel and promote a pro-Palestinian agenda. That's simply their ignorance, but its foundation is anti-Semitism. And they were recently appointed. Omar was recently appointed to House Foreign Affairs Committee. And she decided to take her anti-Israel rhetoric up a notch, and actually she showed her true colors, spreading vicious centuries-old anti-Semitic tropes. This time she attacked AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, combining two stereotypes of anti-Semites. They combined Jewish power and Jewish obsession with money. This is very dangerous. When a congresswoman employs anti-Semitic images and rhetoric, she is encouraging, not preventing, violent incidents. She must be castigated by both Democrats and Republicans in Congress. Members of her own party have condemned her slightly. Like all American citizens, she has the right to express her opinion, but as a legislator and elected representative of the American people, she should be aware about the consequences of her statements. No one expects her to become a sudden lover of Israel and a lover of Jews, but she should not be allowed to use her position on Capitol Hill, particularly in the Foreign Affairs Committee, to disseminate anti-Semitism while pretending to represent American values. After all, a member of Congress is supposed to represent American values, and I like to think that anti-Semitism is not one of them. Spouting anti-Semitic remarks and claiming not to know that they're anti-Semitic should not be seen as acceptable anywhere, and in particular in the American Congress. So I think there's something we have to be aware of. There's a double problem here. The fact this woman is openly anti-Semitic, makes remarks as a member of Congress in committees, and yet the other members of the party are not castigating her enough for what she does. That is a very bad sign for the Democratic Party in the United States. And I just wanted to share these thoughts with the listeners because I think we're going to hear a lot more about this in the future, unfortunately. I'll be back after the break.
Shalom, everybody. Making a difference often takes just one moment and one person at a time. I am Orly Benny Davis, your show host on Israel News Talk Radios from Jerusalem with love. You'll be hearing people talking about politics, religion, social issues, and making a better tomorrow. Join me, Orly Benny Davis, for God and Country from Jerusalem with love.
Wednesdays on Israel News Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Jay Shapiro Show.
I'm going to say a few more words about anti-Semitism. It's not a subject that I intended to speak about this week, but it's a subject that won't go away. And two interesting things happened with allowed the anti-Semitism to raise its ugly head again. One, of course, is the statements by a new Democratic congresswoman in the United States. And the other has to do with the protests taking place in against rising cost of fuel prices in France. These people who were doing this protesting are called the Yellow Vests because that's what they wear. And one would think that having a protest against rising fuel prices would not necessarily involve anti-Semitism. However, that's simply not the case. Anti-Semitism, as we know, is protean. It can take many shapes. Now, what happened was, there is a French Jewish philosopher named Alain Finkielkraut, and he supported the Yellow Vest protesters, and he said he likes this movement from its beginnings and continues to love it. Now, what happened was he attended a rally, and he was standing on the sidelines of one of the Yellow Vest protests, and they were caught on TV, calling him a dirty Jew and a dirty Zionist. They said, you're going to die and you're going to go to hell. Now, Finkielkraut's philosophical writing often focuses on identity-based violence, such as anti-Semitism. Apparently, he came across a group of protesters and he approached them out of curiosity. Then he heard some of the insults, including one telling him to throw himself into the canal. But he does not plan to file a complaint. That's very interesting. French government said on last Tuesday that anti-Semitic acts in France rose 74% in 2018 compared with the previous year. In a separate incident this week, swastikas were sprayed on porches of the late French politician and Holocaust survivor Simone Veil. 14 French political parties plan to hold symbolic meetings against anti-Semitism this week. So it's very, this is what's happening in France. Now, the interesting, you know, France has sort of a history, a famous history of anti-Semitism going back to 1899, or a little bit before that, about 120 years ago, in the case of the famous or infamous Dreyfus case. So now what's happened is, now in France, 14 national political parties are mobilizing to protest. There's also, of course, Islamophobia, but this protest is going to be exclusively against anti-Semitism. The right-left polarizations have put French Jews in a very difficult position. Just as the threat to bipartisanship for American Jewry because of the new Democratic members of the Congress, or the Corbyn factor for British Jewry. Corbyn's the head of the Labour Party. He's an outspoken anti-Semite. Now, the French approach, which is sort of nationalistic, they say anti-Semitism violates the values of the Republic, beginning with liberty, equality, and fraternity. So what they're saying is that anti-Semitism, it's not just not nice against Jews, but it violates basic French beliefs. The very absence of the extreme right and left from the rallies coming now accentuates a return to the center of the of what's happening. As I said, there is swastika graffiti, and these things are going pretty much beyond the pale. It's important to purge the weekly anti-government yellow vest demonstrations from attempted infiltration by anti-Semites. So it's interesting. Here you have some. It's a protest against gas rises in gas prices turned into something anti-Semitic. So it's very interesting how anti-Semitism sort of creeps into everything. And the question is, what's it all mean? In France, at least, a fellow named Philip Val compiled an essay collection, and he writes that anti-Semitism is not the affair of the Jews, but of all, because they see anti-Semitism as a violation of French values. So, but by and large, the media and are silent, because the widest silence, according to the thinkers there, is because the old anti-Semitism of the existing extreme right is added to the anti-Semitism of the radical left, finding an anti-Zionism the alibi to transform the murders of Jews into victims of society, because the electoral system in France calculates that the Muslim vote is 10 times that of the Jewish vote. So there's a lot of Islamophobia also, but they don't say anything about that because they don't want, in a sense, they don't want to bring up the subject of Islamophobia at all. They don't like the word Islam to come up because they're afraid some of the Islamists might misinterpret it. So what they're rising up against is against anti-Semitism because it simply violates French values, the liberty, equality, and fraternity. That's very interesting. Now, back in the United States, there's a problem with these newest Democratic congresswomen. And what happened was that she apologized. And you see, what she apologized is an apology is not an explanation of why you do these things. However, a Jewish state senator from the same state, Minnesota, said, "I believe that the pattern we have seen is an indication of her attitude on the subject rather than ignorance." In other words, all of a sudden the woman says, "Well, I said something that was interpreted as anti-Semitic because I didn't know that the Jews would be upset." But that's a pretension of ignorance. So the United States Jewry, like European Jewry, is confronting anti-Semitism, which is coming not from the fringe elements of society, but the mainstream high-profile personalities. Now, the number of anti-Semitic acts committed against Jews in Europe is much greater. According to studies of 16,000 Jews from 12 European countries commissioned by the European Union's Fundamental Rights Agency, 90% of Jews think anti-Semitism is on the rise. 30% of Jews have experienced anti-Semitic attacks, and 80% of Jews were sad to admit they no longer reported small incidents. They have a thing called the European Union Eurobarometer. They did a poll, and it points out how accustomed the rest of the world has become to today's anti-Semitism, which is simply Jew hatred. Anti-Semitism is a fancy word. This Eurobarometer poll surveyed people from 28 countries, And 89% of Jews responding to the poll reported that anti-Semitism has risen over the past 5 years. Only 36% of the general population believed it has increased. There's a whopping difference in perception between what the Jews see as anti-Semitism rising and what the general population does. CNN conducted its own poll among 7,000 Europeans in seven countries. 20% of those asked responded Jews exert too much control in finance and politics. 34% acknowledged that they knew nothing or little about the Holocaust. 30% of the people admitted to believing that Jews exploit the Holocaust to get their way. That's what's happening in Europe. Jews are avoiding Jewish events and synagogue events. Many are refraining from wearing their kippot. The mug and dovet necklace is no longer dangled proudly by young and old Jews. Many European Jews are considering leaving Europe. The influx of Muslims has changed the nature of Europe and European attitudes toward Jews and the Holocaust. Some say the rise of the radical right neo-Nazi parties, explaining they've created the perfect environment for anti-Semitic attitudes. These groups embrace conspiracy theories that perpetuate the idea that Jews control the world. And that's the same kind of thing that this Minnesota congressman said. These people lack an understanding of why attitudes toward Jews have changed so dramatically in the last 20 years. One answer is that the attitudes have not changed, it's behaviors that have changed, behaviors that have become more public and more acceptable. Anti-Semitic speech is no longer taboo in public. It is even acceptable nowadays to make hateful stereotypes about Israel and about the Jews. And that is what is happening in Europe. Some suggest that it all boils down to Israel's conflict with the Palestinians. They say that the rise of anti-Semitism is a result of tension between Israelis and Palestinians. But this is not an acceptable comment. The world is changing. Each generation of Jews finds more professional doors open to them than their parents did. But the situation is worsening for Jews as a whole. European Jews need to realize what is happening. Attacks against Jews motivated purely out of hatred are on the rise. Some are perpetrated by racists, some by neo-Nazis, and some by Muslim extremists. The only thing that binds them all together is hatred of Jews and hatred of Israel. So Americans, Jews and non-Jews, have to be aware, because anti-Semitism is not something simply against Jews. It's a blot on the country, on the citizenship of the country in which this is taking place. Having said that, I just wanted to get that off my chest. I'll be back after the break.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
This is Shai Bentico, and each week I'll be webcasting to you from Judea, origin of the word Jew, a people besieged and beleaguered in every generation. Nazi Germany is but a memory, but in its place the world invented the phantom Palestinians as this generation's internationally authorized Jew killers. Tune in for a different slant on life in Israel, Phantom Nation, every Monday.
Hi, I'm Rabbi David Aaron. The soul basics are the most profound, the most essential, and yet often the most neglected in our education. Join me for Soul Talk on Israel's News Talk Radio and discover the secrets to love, spiritual growth, and personal power.
You're listening to The Jay Shapiro Show.
Hi, you're back with Jay Shapiro. After spending most of the program about anti-Semitism, I decided to change course a little bit, but I do not know if it's going to be more cheerful. I want to talk about the fact that Islamist thinkers see immigration as an opportunity to conquer the places in which they choose to live and turn them into Islamic states. I've been reading the studies by Dr. Mordechai Kedar of the Begin Sadat Center, who's really an expert on what's happening in the Islamic world, and he speaks Arabic. He's appeared on television in Muslim countries, and he's done an analysis which I think is really worthy of sharing. Essentially says, in the West, if a person's birthplace affords him a feeling of security and a decent way to make a living or a nice home, and it defines somebody with whom to raise a family, that person usually does not try his luck in another country. Emigration becomes a realistic option only when one or more of these elements is not provided by the land of his birth. Now, this is true in the Western world. In the Muslim world, emigration is understood in an entirely different fashion and is based on the precedent set by the Islam's prophet Muhammad, who was humiliated, despised, and almost murdered in his own birthplace, Mecca. The antagonism shown him was a result of the doomsday prophecies he dealt to the people in the city and his attempts to re-educate them. After leaving Mecca in 622 AD, he moved to Medina, and there, after a period of about 2 years, he became the ruler and the military commander. So Muhammad is seen as the ideal role model in Islam, one who cannot possibly mislead his followers, the leader whose every act was guided by a heavenly hand. That means that every Muslim, wherever he is and in whatever situation he finds himself, must follow in Muhammad's footsteps and attempt to imitate his behavior. Since emigration led to a rise in Muhammad's status, his takeover of Medina and its becoming an Islamic city, so Islamic thinkers see that emigration is an opportunity to conquer the places in which they chose to live and turn them into Islamic states. This is the reasoning behind the fact that millions of Muslims rapping on the doors of Europe over the last few years, they come pretty much from failed war-torn states, rife with unemployment, neglect, and despair. They're in search of a secure environment, honorable employment, education for their children, a roof over their heads, and a safe life. Once they achieve economic stability in their host state, many also integrate culturally and become part of the society in which they have found themselves. In contrast, however, there are millions of Muslims settled in Europe who have a clear objective, which is staying loyal to their religious tradition while strengthening its status in Europe. They make demands whose goal is turning the host country into an even more welcoming one. They see the availability of halal foods, no alcohol, no pork, courts acting according to Islamic Sharia law instead of the local statutes, non-marking of Christian holidays, eliminating Holocaust education, the establishment of a banking system according to Islamic law, and allowing Muslim women to wear the niqab, covering their faces in the public sphere. They want their women treated by female medical personnel and not by males, as well as many other demands whose objective is to turn the host country into a place that will attract more Islamic migration. To anyone who keeps his eyes open, it's abundantly clear that these Muslim immigrants who do not integrate into European host country society intend to turn that state into an Islamic entity. They do not have to fire a single bullet to accomplish this. It's perfectly fine with them if the process takes decades, because the Quran states that Allah is with those who are patient. So the Islamic world is quite capable of waiting patiently until its goals are achieved. Muammar Gaddafi, who used to be the president of Libya until he got assassinated, once said that we Muslims do not have to fire a single shot against Europe because our immigration and high birth rate will do the job. The problem with the Europeans is they are forced to accept migrants because of their failing demographics of their own. Two world wars within one century reduced their population by tens of millions. And when they added their low birth rate, makes for a drastic lack of manpower in Europe. Those who are left are interested in the law, accounting, journalism, high tech, and the performing arts. Who is left to work in the factories? Who's willing to be a grocer? Who's willing to be a taxi driver, delivery man? That's where the migrants come in and provide an answer. Europe is progressing in an Islamic direction, slowly but surely. The core problem is that Europe is infected with political correctness, a blind belief in multiculturalism, and guilt feelings about what the Europeans did to indigenous peoples worldwide. For those reasons, anyone talking against migrants is immediately labeled as anti-human rights. Anyone who voices concern about his own people is called a racist. Anyone worried about his country's future is deemed a fascist. Now, anyone who expresses worry for both his country and its people is called a Nazi. This attitude stifles any criticism of immigrants. Although many of them live on the dole, and their percentage among those in prison is far higher than their percentage of the general population. The reason for both phenomena is that the basic values of the host nations, hard work and law observance, have not been absorbed by most of these Islamic immigrants. The rules of the political game have been changed in Europe in response to the massive Islamic migration over the past few years. The nationalist right parties, not the neo-Nazis, considered unacceptable up to 5 years ago because of their perceived racism, have become the most popular parties in Europe. For example, there's a possibility that Austria and Hungary will not remain the only countries with a right-leaning political orientation. Europe's public space has been changed. There's terror in the streets. There are street riots of the kind Parisians have been witnessing for weeks. Entire areas the police are afraid to enter, and ever-growing portions of the economic pie allocated to migrants in the form of unemployment benefits, maternity grants, and other stipends dedicated to helping migrants, which also encourage future waves of migration. Now, this obviously can't go on forever. One of the possible scenarios is that the political right unites to act resolutely against this waves of immigration by legislative means and by deporting migrants back to their country of origin. Even if the left disagrees, it has no practical solution to the problem, and we can assume that the public in Europe is not stupid. The real solution will come about when the Europeans realize that without bringing children into the world, there's no future for their civilization and its culture. They must first change the image of marriage as an institution, because all the substitutes for it have not encouraged women to decide to become mothers. At the same time, Europeans have to consider granting economic benefits to couples who have more than three or four kids. The problem is that at present, there's no legal way when encouraging large families to differentiate between European domestic families and Islamic families who have attained citizenship. Europe is at an impasse that will lead to cultural suicide if the rules of the game are not changed fundamentally. Israel really has to look for new friends in Eastern Asia, because the number of its friends in Europe are becoming fewer and fewer. So Israel has to look in Asia, South America, and of course the United States, which is a bulwark of friendship for the state of Israel. Because all of this, among other reasons, is because in the very near future, an Islamic Europe will not be pro-Israel. That's the situation today. In the beginning of the program, I talk about anti-Semitism, but as I am implying now, and I am trying to give the listeners to understand the growing Islamic presence in Europe means that Israel will have fewer and fewer opportunities to have European cooperation in what's happening here in the Middle East. The Europeans are going to see the world quite differently in the next several decades than they've seen in the past. Now, Europe has never been overwhelmingly friendly to the Jews. There was pangs of conscience after the Holocaust. But in parallel with the conscience pangs disappearing, the increase in the Islamic population in Europe is acting in a way that is detrimental to the friendship between European countries and Israel. And therefore, it's incumbent upon Israel to look for friends in other places of the world, all the other places of the world, from South America to Africa to the Far East. And, of course, we have our one major friend, thank God, the United States. So I just wanted to share some thoughts about our relationship with Europe. Till next time, Jay Shapiro signing off. Be well.
Israel News Talk Radio's chat room. Just click the orange button at the top of the IsraelNewsTalkRadio.com homepage, log in as yourself or an anonymous guest, and join in on the fun. You'll meet other listeners from all over the world who listen to Israel News Talk Radio, and you can make new friends. Israel News Talk Radio's chat room. It's the closest you can get to being in the studio with us.
We love listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
Where can you get the inside news on Israel? At Israel News Talk Radio, we're dedicated to sharing Israel's inside story with the world by providing our listeners with news on Israeli politics, current affairs, and Israeli Jewish culture. The Israel News Talk Radio homepage also provides you, the listener, with useful information at your fingertips, with scrolling news headlines, weather, currency exchange, Shabbat candle lighting times, and so much more. Our radio programming is always accessible and on demand. We operate absolutely free of charge for everyone, everywhere. If you love what we do, partner with us now by becoming an Israel News Talk Radio supporter. With your support, you'll be inscribed on our Israel News Talk Radio Wall of Fame. There's nothing like us in the world. Be part of something great. Israel News Talk Radio, straight talk from Israel.
If you love Israel News Talk Radio, then you'll love our Facebook page. We keep you up to date on what's happening in Israel, plus little surprise treasures that we don't share on the radio. Go now to follow us on Facebook. Just look for the Israel News Talk Radio Facebook page, and don't forget to subscribe and follow us by clicking on the like button. We post great stuff there that you'll want to share. Israel News Talk Radio on Facebook and Israel News Radio on Twitter.
News, opinion, and more. You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.